thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Like every day.
Here's John Williams.
It's what we do here for you. It's 109. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. We'll be here until 3. Ryan Burrow for ABC Radio and our Doma Tipango are in Memphis, and we'll be hearing from them throughout the afternoon as well. We've been hearing from them this week, and so we'll check in with the Dominator, whose story also appears in today's Chicago Sun-Times. We've partnered with the Sun-Times for some coverage. I think the Sun-Times did a nice job today. On page one, Mary Mitchell's piece talks about something that we will talk about later in the show in the 2 o'clock hour, Martin Luther King's move through Chicago and what that meant to him and to us. That's in the 2 o'clock hour. Well done, Mary. Well done, Doma T. Doesn't seem like spring out there, though, does it? I'll tell you a couple things, though, that do remind me that spring is going to be here. And I'm always inventing carrots for myself. I just put them on a stick and I hold them out there and I keep going. It's sort of like the bright side. If you can't think of one, you've got to come up with one on Friday, something that makes you happy. And when I see promos for a news story about the Kentucky Derby, I go, the Kentucky Derby, that always means warm weather's coming. I saw something for NASCAR. Kim, you would appreciate this. You're into car racing, right?
Oh, absolutely. I'm more of a Kentucky Derby girl since I was born and raised there.
But, yeah, you are.
But I do love, you know, a good car race.
When I like a mint julep.
Really?
And a beautiful hat.
If it gives you a reason to drink and wear fun clothes, hooray. Daytona's going to happen, and the Masters is going to happen as well. I mean, this reportage now about how Tiger Woods is actually one of the favorite golfers to win the thing. I would love to see Tiger win the Masters. I was reading some coverage about the Masters, though, and they say that, you know how when the guy hits the ball and then somebody shouts out, be the man, or cupcakes and sprinkles or whatever it is that they shout out.
I don't think that goes well at Augusta.
Well, I guess they do. But they said, if you say the following phrase this year, you will be escorted from the premises. This phrase is banned from shouting in the tee box area and therefore on TV at the Masters this year. Do you know what the phrase is?
Fake news pops into my head, but
I know. I was just saying, and I know since everybody's seen that, I'll tell you right now, it's not political. It's weird, actually, because it's a fun phrase, and
booyah.
It's everywhere. Booyah is one they often say, and that's one they evidently can still say. That's not the banned one I'm thinking of.
Dilly Dilly?
Dilly Dilly is it.
Really?
Dilly
Is Bud not a sponsor?
That's, you know, the story I read didn't have an explanation for that, so I'm guessing that's the reason.
Kicked out, huh?
Yeah, interesting.
And I'll tell you what, if you have Masters tickets, if you are watching Tiger Woods or somebody hit it at the Masters, that is like a life experience for people. That's, if you go to like one of these auctions in town and somebody's donated Masters tickets, those will go for thousands of dollars.
Oh, my husband went last year. It was the biggest bucket list item he's, you know, on his bucket list.
Yeah, my brother did the same thing, made it to one of those. And if you've got an hour, he'll tell you about it. So this is a big deal. So I suspect, I guess the point is that people will comply.
But if you tell me the one word I can't say, I can't think of anything else right now other than Dilly Dilly.
I know.
Well, what if there's a golfer and his name is Billy and they're going Billy Billy and they think it's Dilly Dilly and you, then you get out.
I swear I didn't say it. I swear.
William. You go by William in that case. William, William. If you don't know what Dilly Dilly is, here's a soundbite from the Dilly Dilly commercial that ran in the Super Bowl. I think that Bud Light campaign, when a friend of ours here at the radio station, Duffy, was chirping Dilly Dilly a lot when the campaign started. And I didn't get it or think it was all that funny. I love that campaign. I think the Dilly Dilly campaign, every single one of those commercials, I think continues to be funny. On the Super Bowl, they had one that went a little bit like this.
Madam Susan, you are an even truer friend of the crown. Dilly Dilly.
Dilly Dilly.
Then up comes a guy.
What is that?
This is a spiced honey mead wine that I have really been into lately. So, Dilly Dilly? Right?
Please follow Sir Brad. He's going to give you a private tour of the pit of misery.
The ad works in so many ways.
Pit of misery, dilly dilly.
Dilly dilly, because if you see this guy, too, who comes into this, you know, there's this craft brew that I'm really into right now. I swear to God, you've seen that guy at any of the brew houses in town. I know I saw him at Half Acre.
Or the guy who brings it to, like, a basketball game at your house, and you're like, could you get the 24-pack, not the three really expensive ones?
Right. They'll bring the 4-pack in, and then you go, all right, well, I guess those are your beers, but now we can't have your fancy-colored beer.
Yeah.
And they've all got red beards and they're wearing flannel or whatever the thing is. funny campaign. And so don't say dilly dilly if you're lucky enough to get tickets. Opening day is tomorrow at Sox Park. Lucky us, huh? I mean, we've been looking forward to this for weeks and weeks now.
It's going
to
be a party.
It's going to be cold.
No, but we're going to be inside. You're fine.
Yeah, but as it turns out, it's an outdoor stadium.
Oh.
If women ran the world, I truly believe this, the first, I don't know, 2 weeks of baseball, the first not just 1 week, the first 2 weeks of baseball, all games would be played in either stadiums south of, I don't know, St. Louis or in indoor stadiums north of St. Louis. You wouldn't be in this pickle.
And why would that be?
Why women? Because I just think women are better organized.
Right, because we're thinking ahead. We're okay with changing our mind.
Exactly. But guys are like, oh yeah, I guess that's a bad idea, Bob. That's
we got to stick to it.
I know. That's
don't
guys.
Change.
Women, I think there'd be fewer wars and less games in cold weather.
Are we going to gender bash the whole show or just the beginning?
Women ran the world.
Oh, he's a little sensitive today. Be
Steve
nice.
Is. Steve is a very... Steve is always championing the rights of men.
I prefer to treat people equally.
Yeah, I know that.
And you're allowed to be sensitive.
No, but I think Steve's always on point. I mean, I get it. I just don't think this is the first cause. I've got spotted owls above white men, but it's so easy to make fun of boys or white men. And every now and then Steve goes, you know, well, I don't need to speak for him. He's right here. But the defense starts that way, right, Steve?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, yeah. By the way, speaking of shots at and defenses for, so I'm reading the Chicago Tribune today. Actually, our friend Kathy was over this morning, and she was reading the Tribune with us. We have the print and online editions. If you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. We've got two swell ones in town, and I think patronizing the sponsors of talk radio shows would be a good idea, too, just to support free speech and great journalism. But the Cal Thomas perspective on the editorial pages of the Chicago Tribune today is without a doubt the dumbest, meanest thing I have read in either of the city's newspapers in a very long time. And maybe that's somebody's idea of diversity in opinion. There's enough liberal print these days, so let's make sure we get some conservative print. If that was the thinking, I still don't think this evens anything out because this is just stupid. I mean, maybe it's conservative, but are you kidding me? The piece in the Tribune today by Cal Thomas is worth reading without any editorial comment from me. In part, Thomas says this. He is headlined, "Free Speech Takes Another Hit from Thin-Skinned Liberals," and there's a picture of 17-year-old David Hogg, and underneath him is a picture of Laura Ingraham. And while the Tribune didn't, I guess, commission this, he's a syndicated columnist, I don't know why they chose to run this. It reads, in part, "David Hogg, rejected by four colleges to which he applied and whines about it, dinged by UCLA with a 4.1 GPA, totally predictable given the acceptance rates." That's Fox News host Laura Ingraham, the tweet she put out, for which she has since apologized. The 17-year-old Hogg, he writes, a survivor of the February 14th mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, is the new face of the anti-gun movement, having achieved overnight victim status, reserved apparently only for those on the left, which supposedly insulates him from criticism. Hogg rejected Ingraham's apology and called her a bully. "Whatever happened to sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me." If Hogg thinks he's being bullied by Ingraham, how would he react to a real bully, the kind who punches you in the face? Hogg should have asked to appear on Ingraham's show, where the two could have debated the issue. Instead, he swiped at Ingram in the media. Isn't there something a little cowardly about that? Cal Thomas says, I first met Laura Ingram in the early 1980s. Laura is a kind, compassionate woman and a practicing Roman Catholic. She's a single mother of three adopted children who might have experienced a far different life without her. She's also a breast cancer survivor. The left says things far worse than what she tweeted about David Hogg. Speaking of comparisons, recall what Joy Behar said on ABC's The View about Vice President Mike Pence's Christian faith. She mocked his beliefs and suggested they might reflect a mental illness. Apparently under similar pressure from ABC, Behar apologized on the air and went further, calling Vice President and apologizing to him directly. Hogg instead spewed worse profanities and insulted parents. If he were my kid and behaved as he does, he'd be grounded. And if the behavior continued, Cal Thomas says about 17-year-old David Hogg, who's still processing, surviving a mass shooting in his school, he would be shown the door. He would be told, he'd have to find somewhere else to live. Some sponsors have pulled their commercials from Ingram's show, as some did after Behar's insulting remark. But instead of boycotts and threats, how about celebrating the First Amendment by encouraging people to say what they think? Debate is better than boycotts. Let David Hogg speak his immature mind and let Laura Ingram have her say, and then let them debate each other, assuming Hogg doesn't want to adopt another role, that of coward. I'm just stunned at that article. I'm just stunned at that. I mean, like, if somebody at the Tribune read that, they go, okay, this is provocative, but we don't have to run it, so why run? This is Cal Thomas calling this 17-year-old kid twice in this one column a coward. And by the way, the idea of, this makes me nuts, the idea that David Hogg should go on Laura Ingram's show and debate gun control is insane. She's a professional broadcaster who's been doing this for years and years and years and years and years. Last month, he was an anonymous 17-year-old whose school got shot up. Maybe he could hold his own. I'll bet he couldn't. I'll bet her facts, her lawyerly knowledge, she would be able to talk circles around the issue around him. She'd whoop any of us. So the idea that he needs to or owes her a fair debate on her show, I think is a trap I would not fall into if I were him. Don't go there, kid. You don't need to. You need counseling. And you need to do whatever it is that you want to do with this. But I'd also like to see some of those kids just go back to being regular 17-year-olds as best they can. But I'm not here to call him a coward. That is just amazing to me. It's interesting. Violetta just handed me, I'm looking at V and talking about Elif. Elif just handed me the story from the New York Daily News about not shouting dilly dilly at the Masters. In response, Bud Light has sent or is sending 1,000 T-shirts that say Dilly Dilly to the event for the fans to wear. They say that too many people are just getting too rowdy at golf events. Some of them are getting drunk and getting rowdy. Rory McIlroy suggested limiting alcohol sales at events after one fan kept yelling his wife's name at the Arnold Palmer Invitational.
It is weird. It's been a long time now, but when they cheer after every stroke or after every tee off, it's like, come on.
I know. You don't even know where the ball's going. Ah! I don't understand that, but that's what it is. I don't know that you get to take that away from the fans. Sports evolve. Fans evolve.
Oh, no. I take it away. Come on. You're really the king. Take it away.
Dilly dilly.
Make it stop.
Dilly dilly.
Make that stop.
You heard Doma Tipango earlier today. Let's listen to him again from WGN Radio News. You can read his story in today's Chicago Sun-Times, too. Hi, Doma T. How are you?
I'm good, John. How you doing?
Good. You are in Memphis. Ryan is there, too. Where exactly are you right now?
Right now, I ran back to the hotel to make sure I had a good reception to be able to call you. But just prior to that, I was at the National Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Hansberry Hotel.
I see. Yeah, that's quite the shrine's not the right word, but a lot of people are attracted to that. A lot of people go there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Right now, it's been transformed into what almost looks like a concert venue. There's a high stage. There are hundreds of people out there now. At this point, I expect hundreds more to be coming out there, if not close to 1,000, if not more than 1,000. There were marches earlier this morning. I talked a bit about this, about the labor unions organizing marches to recreate the very same march the sanitation workers did 50 years ago yesterday, and when they were conducting their strike. And now there are going to be a number of speakers. Performances are happening right now. It feels like a mixture between a rally, a concert, and a call to action.
Yeah. I heard you talking earlier, and a lot of the shows have. Steve Cochran was talking about this, too. You know, what's the appropriate attitude or emotion? Is it celebratory, or is it sad, or is it, you know, action-oriented? I guess it's a little bit of all of those things, huh?
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. It's so interesting, because depending on who you ask, that's the answer you get. And I think what's so interesting about it is it also – the speakers, the lens through which they see the world, the moods with which they speak, really determines and kind of sets the mood for the audience. Like tonight, the keynote speaker will be Reverend Michael Flager. Chicago is well represented out here in Memphis tonight. And Father Mike said, you know, I don't know if I deserve this honor. I don't know if I should be speaking, but I don't know if many people know how he wouldn't be a priest if not for the Reverend Dr. King. And I imagine that his remarks will largely speak to this idea of hope, this idea of allyship and inclusiveness. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how the mood changes once he begins to speak at 5:30 tonight.
He's an interesting representation of the inclusiveness ideal. You know, to be honest with you, I forgot that when he gave the mountaintop speech, Martin Luther King, that it was in front of sanitation workers. I love that something that is that beautiful was given to people who you might say on the economic scale were lowly. You know, not only were they Black Americans, but probably and not paid well, but you know, who aspires to be a garbage truck man? And yet there they were, and Martin Luther King gave them that speech. How fantastic is that? You know,
that's remarkable, and it's right in step with what King would say. He'd say, whether you are a street sweeper, whether you are a garbage man, whatever it is that you want to do, you have to absolutely do it to the best of your ability. If you're going to clean the streets, say, I'm going to be the best doggone street cleaner that ever existed. And so he really regarded every single person as he would regard himself. And it was actually a pivot from not only focusing on racial issues, but he began this poor people's campaign.
Right.
And
right.
What brought him to Memphis, sanitation workers, they had these poor working conditions. The two individuals actually died because the mechanism that they used to put the trash in the trucks actually failed, causing them to lose their lives. And you know, he said, okay, enough is enough. And it got to the point where human lives weren't valued based on what your socioeconomic status was. And he felt that was just wrong. You know, you bring a good point up with that.
Our Domati Pongo is in Memphis. I got to go, Domati, but 3:00 Central Time, things start to get going again. That's when some of these events actually start.
Yeah, really quick. Let me squeeze this in. 3:00. Things really begin to kick off. Some of the speakers will be, actually, she spoke earlier, Tamika Mallory, who was one of the leaders in the Women's March. A lot of people have been talking about the Women's March and the youth who have been marching for gun control advocacy and how those movements intersect with Dr. King. Speaking tonight, of course, Father Michael Flager, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, and a number of other speakers and modern-day civil rights leaders carrying the torch for Dr. King. So we'll be back there, and in my series tomorrow, I'll recap what happened today.
And today's Chicago Sun-Times, your story begins. Dad, don't go. Well done, my friend. We'll visit with you later.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sunshine, lollipops.
More happy music this week.
Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together.
Hey, let's go to a ball game.
Penny, when you're near the
29 degrees and blustery. I can't wait.
Just to know that you are mine.
Got up this morning, looked out the sliding glass door, and saw nothing but white. And I thought, that's funny. joy. Our deck isn't white.
Everybody, sunshine, lollipops.
What could that be?
Rainbows, everything that's wonderful is sure to...
It was still a shock, even though you knew it was coming.
I know. They said, you know, when they say it's going to snow, it doesn't always snow.
Mm-hmm.
So you open up that first eyeball and you think, I hope they're wrong. They weren't.
They weren't.
Phil Vitale's in our studio, restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune. Hi, Phil. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I can take the winter weather. I expect it. But weather like this in April feels like a broken promise.
Keep going. That's beautiful.
I feel betrayed.
That's beautiful.
So you got a bloody nose.
I know. Pow! Cow! Biff! Phil wrote in the Tribune today about Sky, S-K-Y. Is that how you pronounce it, Sky, or S-K-Y?
I pronounce it Sky. I hope I'm doing it right.
S period, K period, Y period. Finally in full flight, Pilsen Hotspot soars. It's got 3 stars, and there's a beautiful picture of the dish that you were writing about there, a delicately non-traditional...
Bibimbap.
Excuse me?
Bibimbap.
Bop-bop-a-loo-da-bop-bop-bam.
Where it comes from, sure.
No. With silky foie gras instead of a soft egg, along with mushrooms, broccolini, scallions, and toasted nori. And I got to tell you, that does not look good to me.
Really?
Well, that's just not my cup of tea.
There you go.
But I think a lot of people are looking at it and making reservations right now.
It's a pretty dish. The funny thing is...
It's a beautiful dish. It's just not my kind of food.
And presented very compartmentalized, so the nori's in one place.
Yeah.
And the broccolini's in another place, then the foie sits on top. But what you're supposed to do when it comes to your table is get out your fork and spoon, just dig into it and mash it up, and as you would when someone gives you a steak tartare, say.
Yeah.
You have the egg on top, and you do a little mushing at the table, and then you eat it.
Nobody's ever given me a steak tartare. And by the way, what is bitmap? What is that? Bippy Mappa.
Bibimbap is a traditional Korean dish, usually with...
is that chicken?
Usually
in
with
there?
Beef. It's usually beef.
Beef.
This time it's the foie gras on top, and there's mushrooms, and there's nori. There's not beef, but
what's foie gras?
Foie gras is fattened duck liver.
Didn't we ban that in Chicago
for about a year and a half, 2 years almost? Yeah.
But it's okay now. It's legal again.
Yeah, they overturned the ban. It was a silly thing.
Well, not if you're a goose.
No, there's almost no goose foie gras in this country. Almost none. It's all duck.
Okay, fine. Not if you're a duck. I mean, if I'm a duck, I'm not crazy about being force-fed a lot of food, enlarging my liver, and then having you take it. How good is that for the duck?
Well, the last few days aren't great. But then again, the last few days of your life probably aren't going to be great either. We all check out more or less the same way, you know, kind of wheezing, hard to move, you know.
So this is Korean food at Sky?
It is not, but it is Korean-inspired. His wife, whose initials are SKY, is Korean. He is, I believe, half Filipino. And so they visit Korea a lot. That's where they got married. And so he knows a lot about that kind of food. But he just, at the same time, he has a wife and a family that would be, you know, no matter how he would try to make it perfectly authentic, it probably wouldn't. So he doesn't even try. He takes those ingredients and he just plays with them. So it's sort of the flavors will remind you of Korean food. It would not be a strictly... I don't think there's a strict Korean dish on the menu at all.
So I don't know what people are going to think when they come in there. Who would you recommend go to a restaurant like this then? If it's not traditional Korean, it sure ain't American.
No, but I mean, you can still get a chicken there. You can still get a pasta dish there. It's not. I highlighted that bibimbap because it's such a pretty dish, I think, and it really speaks to what he's trying to do. But this is not going to strike you if you sat down and looked at the entire menu and say, "What country am I in?" Because you wouldn't. You'd say, "I'm here in Chicago, and this kind of looks good." Or in your case, not so good.
I'm only reacting to my own personal... You and I had this conversation off the air just as you sat down today, and I said that a lot of reasons I shouldn't be a food journalist, but one of them is my palate just isn't that broad. And I asked you if you always had an interest in eating everything, and you said...
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a dream. This is the perfect job for you.
Yeah. I'm good like a journalist. Vacuum cleaner with a brand new bag. Just point me at it.
Well, give me one other dish you really liked at Sky in Pilsen.
I wrote this a week and a half ago, even though it's in the paper today. So what did I...
You want me to read it to you?
Yeah, please.
says they hit town in 2015. After instead, he fell in love with it. This is the part where I just got the front page
the
here.
Back page.
Yeah, no, I don't.
It should be on page 7. It should be in the inside fold.
Yeah, see what I did.
That's it in black and white. That's the rest of it.
Oh, hello, Asian inspired anyone? Well, you featured in here hamaki sashimi. Is served at Sky with black sesame seeds, dribbles of ponzu, and crispy bits of puffed rice.
You could expect to see that in any Japanese restaurant.
Maine lobster dumplings you liked.
Mm-hmm.
You liked the cheesecake there.
Oh, that's
and the organic fried chicken with fermented hot sauce and creamed corn.
Yeah.
It does sound actually pretty good, doesn't it?
It is very good. And that because he ferments the hot sauce, it has these. It has a depth of flavor that of just a plain, real hot sauce that just burns your tonsils. Doesn't have. It's just got this real great depth.
Two quick questions about ballpark food.
Mm-hmm.
That is...
Which ballpark?
Well, one about each, actually.
Right.
So we will tomorrow be at Sox Park.
All right.
Guaranteed rate field. You have not, though one of your colleagues did review the food there last year. I wonder if somebody going to make the trip over and write it up again this year, do you know?
I don't know. We did such an exhaustive report last time. We ate every single thing. I think Nick hit a couple of the new items about a week ago that they were being shown to us.
I'm more interested in eating around the park. Now, we're going to be at Cork and Kerry tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
We asked you for some other places that might be nearby, and you gave us a list of Nana, Takira San Jose, Ed's Pot Sticker House. I love the sound of that.
They make these unusual for us pot stickers. His are longer; they're cigar shaped, but they're really tasty. And it's a cute little place. It's right there on Halsted Street, around between 31st and 32nd.
We'll put this list on my page, my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John on Facebook. 35th Street Red Hots, Maxwell Street Depot. I don't know that I've been there.
It's as the name would suggest, with Maxwell Street, it's going to have a lot of Polish sausage. Particularly good is the pork chop sandwich there.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That sounds good. I'm hungry
that's
right
real
now.
Good one. Nick
Maxwell
swore
Street
by
Depot.
It.
Yeah. 31st Street. Han 202. Riccobini.
Yep. They're most famous for their breaded steak sandwich.
Polo Cafe on Morgan, and Duck Inn on Eleanor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Polo Cafe is a nice steak, seafood, pasta place about a mile west of the ballpark. Kevin Hickey has the Duck Inn. He's a Bridgeport born and raised, and he's doing really sophisticated food, but it's really approachable. Of course, he does a whole duck for two, which is just a knockout dish, just an absolutely tremendous duck.
You're going to review the restaurants in the new building across from Wrigley Field. They've got that hotel there now.
I am. When they open, one's open now, a couple are, and next week I'll have a little rundown of all these places, some of which will be open in time for opening day, which is a week from Monday, last Monday.
Yeah.
And
Monday.
Thank you. That's another way of
saying it. Also known as Monday.
Also called Monday. That's a good system. I got to work on that. And so some will be open for opening day. A couple are open already. And we've got a few that are going to be further down the season.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Phil. Read Phil Vitale in the Chicago Tribune, even
please,
if he doesn't. Because
I'm halfway through that story I just talked about. I've got that in my head. I can't remember. I know how embarrassing.
It's good to see you, Phil. Thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
Phil Vitale, Chicago Tribune restaurant critic.
It's your non sequitur of the day.
Hey, hey!
Come on.
There's our non sequitur.
Non sequitur.
Listen carefully.
I felt like a poor Billy Joel, for Christ's sake. <you know?
laughs> It's your non sequitur of the day.
All right, this is a clip from one of our shows.
It's time to
tell us who this is.
Non sequitur.
What's he talking about?
I felt like a poor Billy Joel, for Christ's sake. You know?
I don't know why that makes me laugh, but it does. Who was on with Bill and Wendy saying, I feel like a poor Billy Joel? That's our non sequitur of the day. Call me right now, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. You get it right, you get a prize.
It's your non sequitur of the day.
Earlier today.
Come on, it's time to play. Non sequitur.
Jeff, you're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Good. Who was that?
That was Eddie Money.
And what was he talking about?
He was talking about his top 100 or top 25 hits he had for music.
Yeah, right. And he said, you know, I'm like a poor man's Billy Joel.
Or, I think he said he had 20 top 100 hits.
Yeah, it was, and I think it might have even been more than 20, but he was top 100 hits, and it was 20 or 30 or some, 23, Elif. 23, Elif went back and heard it, 23 top 100 hits. And when they talk to rock and roll stars, they know their stuff. You know, she's a rock jock. Bill knows that industry really well. It was a fun conversation they had today. I don't have any tickets for you, though, to the concert or anything. That'd be
It's a
swell.
TV. It's a reality TV show, I think.
Oh, that's right. Actually, yeah. So he's not coming to town to sing. He was just talking about the... And it was weird, too, because, you know, he described a really sweet scene with his family that got onto this one show. And then they said, hey, that was interesting. Let's do a reality show. But the show, the scene he was describing was... Where he says, look, I'm an alcoholic. I don't want any booze in the house. He goes up to his son's room. He hears his son and daughter fighting and finds half a bottle of booze in the room. So he's outraged and they're all screaming and yelling at each other. And I guess that's on this one show. And somebody called him and said, hey, let's make a reality show with your family, too. So that's what they were talking about today. I do have a prize for you, though, if you'd like. I've got the desktop indoor weather station. Brought to you by American Weathermakers, Heating and Cooling, the 60-Minute Men. And you want to go to Malnati's on us sometime, too? Get a pizza? How's that sound, Jeff?
That would be awesome. Thank you.
Hey, real good. Thanks for listening to them. Thanks for listening to us. Elif, here's the payoff punch on WGN.
With a lot of great tunes, I had like 23 songs in the top 100. I mean, I felt like a poor Billy Joel, for Christ's sake. <you know?
laughs> That was your non sequitur of the day. For all the winners, I say hooray. Non sequitur.
156. Steve will do the news in about 3.5 minutes, including the story about some Loyola University teachers who are now on the picket line. We'll also visit with the Vice President for Interpretation and Education at the Chicago History Museum. They have an MLK gallery up, and Martin Luther King's visit to Chicago has some stories that maybe you have not heard. We'll tell them.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
It's 207 on GN Radio. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. And we're here until 3 o'clock. Saturdays, you can hear my show from 10 a.m. until noon. On all social media, I'm WGN King John. Like, follow, and do all that stuff with me there. And I think you'll be glad that you did. By the way, just real quick, so do we have the audio of what happened at the Braves game? So the Nationals are playing the Braves. I guess this is in Atlanta. Steve pointed this out to me, so I don't have the whole backstory. But I guess there's some rumors that the Cubs are going to try and acquire Bryce Harper. So go ahead and hit it.
Number 34, Bryce Harper.
They played Go Cubs Go. So there's, I don't know if the, I'm trying to think now, do the opposing players get walk-up songs? I don't think they do, but they were playing Go Cubs Go. Kevin is just sitting into the sports spot right now. Kevin, are the Cubs making an effort to try and acquire Bryce Harper?
I don't know if the Cubs are at a hand in this at all, but it's definitely funny. I think it's the Braves sort of mocking Nationals, so I don't think it's necessarily the Cubs, but Cub fans can dream, and they are hoping for a Bryce Harper signing with the Cubs. But, you know, it's going to be tough. If the Cubs do want to sign Bryce Harper, there's been talk of $300-$400 million contract.
Well, that's the thing.
That.
And we've got a good right fielder. I mean,
do you?
Maybe we don't.
Well, Jason Hayward's a hell of a defensive player. Yeah. The art of hitting eludes the man.
Okay, but here's my point. Do we need that? I mean, I thought we were going to win there I go again. I thought the Cubs were going to win the World Series this year anyway. Would you spend $300 million or $400 million on Bryce Harper right now?
Yeah, if you can afford it, and the Cubs can afford it.
Really, they can?
Yeah, well, they're going to have their new TV deal in a couple of years.
So think of all the other things you could do with $300 or $400 million. I mean, you could get two $200 million players.
Yeah, but who, though? And I mean, they don't really have any holes. Their starting five's pretty much set now for at least the next couple of years.
Well, that's why I'm counting dollars. I'm thinking...
I mean, at this point, it would just be, just complete gluttony, excessiveness for the Cubs, but it would make them the clear-cut... best team in baseball.
Well, remember the year they won the, I don't know if you remember, but they won the World Series a couple years ago.
Heard about that.
And their starting lineup was the All-Star team. I mean, it was the starting infield and the pitcher.
Yeah. Yeah, they had Bryant, Russell, Zobrist, and Rizzo.
And then, but we didn't have the starting pitcher, did we? Or,
I believe it was. Was it, it was Lester?
Arrieta,
one of the two.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was impressive. So, you know, I wouldn't rule out Bryce Harper. For a while, I'm like, this is crazy. There's no chance.
Okay, but then what happened at the game? Then why were they playing Go Cubs Go when he stepped up against the Braves?
Because everyone keeps associating, you know, Harper has like a bromance with Chris Bryant. They're buddies. They played together.
Yeah.
They grew up in Las Vegas together, that area, and played youth baseball. So those two, like Cub fans are trying to connect the dots. It's like conspiracy theorists kind of like, you know.
Right.
Like, but, wow, did you guys see on Instagram Bryce Harper's playing? He's building a puzzle with Chris Bryant tonight and they're hanging out and their wives are really good friends and girlfriends are friends or whatever.
Yeah.
So the Cub fans are trying to like piece. And I think he was wearing a Bulls shirt or something like that in an Instagram post with Chris Bryant, so that led people. So, like, everyone in baseball, the baseball world, is just kind of assuming that there's that link there with Bryce Harper and Chris Bryant. So, Cub fans keep throwing the idea, maybe Bryce Harper to the Cubs, maybe Bryce Harper to the Cubs. And honestly, for a while, like, no chance. And now I'm kind of like, you know, maybe this could happen. Yeah. Which it would be wild if Bryce Harper came here. But you're looking at a $300-400 million contract.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I get $1 billion, I've talked to my wife about this. Yeah. I said, do not let me spend $300 million on a baseball player.
On anything.
On anything.
Yes, a baseball
because
player.
You spend $300-400 million on a baseball player. You go, this Bryce Harper is the best thing that could ever happen. Yeah. And then he gets injured. Right. You know, or I don't know, and then something happens. So yeah. I'm not spending that money.
You know, if you do, the one thing I will say, though, even if I think they can afford that, but keep in mind, all these young core players are eventually going to be due and be free agency eligible. Chris Bryant in 2021.
Yeah.
You know, Addison Russell down the road, Javi Baez, all these guys that you're paying not a whole lot of money, they're going to be due for. You know, you think Chris Bryant in 2021 is not going to be thinking the figures Harper's going to get? I mean, Bryant's probably envisioning a $300-400 million contract in 3 years.
All right, but if you're only going to have one of those, this last question I got to ask you because I got to do something else, but who would you take?
I think you got to stick with Bryant.
Hello?
He's pretty incredible. Yeah. Yeah. I would stick with Chris Bryant.
It's 212 on WGN. We'll keep you posted on the walk-up songs for...
That's pretty damn funny what the Braves did, though. That's the essence of trolling
Bryce Harper. Yeah. It's 212 on WGN Radio. You remember the name Nevis Coleman? Nevis Coleman was all over the news a week ago. He's a young African-American, but he's actually a middle-aged black man who was recently released from jail. He's one of the grounds crew at Guaranteed Rate Field for the White Sox. He was wrongly jailed for a couple of decades. DNA tests have since exonerated him. And it was a nice story because the White Sox said, hey, we still got your job back. And he's such a good guy. He seems to be so great about it. And I had a million questions when that story broke. Now, the guy that was representing him was away for a while, but he's back and he's in our studio. So we asked Russell Ainsworth, a partner at, say the name of the firm?
Lovey and Lovey, L-O-E-V-Y,
to join us. He's also part of the Exoneration Project, which got him released. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
The crime for which he was committed was so terrible, I don't really want us to describe it, but it was a rape and a murder of a young woman. How was it that he was convicted of that crime?
The woman's body was found in the basement of Nevis Coleman's family's apartment building.
He was there for a birthday party of his sister.
He had been to a gathering of people next door. He saw the victim a few weeks before, and then her body was found in his basement, and he was one of the people who discovered her body in an abandoned basement.
So then they questioned him about it? Naturally, I suppose.
They questioned him, and they released him. And he went back home, and then in the middle of the night, he was picked up again by police detectives who have a notorious history of abusing suspects and gaining confessions. 1994.
So they then haul him back in for questioning, and he eventually confesses to it, right?
And he was 25 years old, living in Englewood, in a time when it was a very turbulent area. Nevis Coleman had never been arrested before. He had no convictions.
Was he working for the Sox at the time? Did he have a job?
He was working full-time as a groundskeeper for the White Sox. He had that job for 2 years. You know, he had worked consistently since graduating high school, 7 years employment.
Why did he confess to it?
So he was abused during his interrogation. He was beaten. He was called the N-word. He was told that he was made to believe that the only way out of that room was to cooperate with the detectives.
That came up in the Tribune story. Comment on this. So what they evidently tell these guys is, look, just sign this piece of paper, you know, or we'll write something and you sign it, or tell us something and dictate it, and we'll. But it's almost as if it's make believe. Just do that, and then we'll all be able to go home. But they don't maybe necessarily explain to them that when you do this, you're going to go away to jail for a long time.
What they lead the person to believe is that they need a witness to tell on other people, and if Nevis Coleman cooperates and he does the role that they want him to play, then he can go home. They're really looking at other guys. And so they get Nevis Coleman to implicate two other men and himself in so doing. And he's told that he's going to go home if he does this.
Was there a trial then for him? Or since he's confessed, there's no trial? What happens?
So then he had a trial by jury, and the confession was introduced to him, and that was the only evidence.
Oh, so he didn't plead guilty, even though he had confessed. Well, now that's a conundrum, isn't it?
He was facing the death penalty. And I'll tell you this, John, something about Nevis Coleman. Even though he was convicted of this horrific rape murder, even after he was convicted, 30 people came to a sentencing hearing. Friends, clergy, family members, co-workers, all to speak on his behalf, all to speak to his character, his good nature, even after he'd been convicted of this horrible crime. Because they knew he wasn't the kind of person who would do this thing.
How long was he sentenced?
He was given natural life in prison.
Then why, 23 years later, does DNA evidence that exonerates him surface?
So the DNA was always there. But back in 1994, we didn't have the capacity to test everywhere we would want to test now. And so places that were tested now included the underwear of the victim, her sweater that she was wearing, DNA from underneath her fingernails. And we look at DNA underneath her fingernails because that's often a clue of the attacker.
And did they find a match?
And they did find a match. It all excluded Nevis Coleman, excluded his co-defendant, and it implicated a man who had committed at least three other rapes.
Is that man in jail?
That man is not in jail.
That man is maybe free today?
Maybe free today.
But the DNA that they got from her fingernails and on her clothes and on her body elsewhere was all consistent. It was one single person. So she's fighting somebody off, and they have semen or something else.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. What was the trial like then? I mean, if all they had was this confession that may have been forced, he's pleading not guilty. They didn't have eyewitnesses to him doing it, not honest ones. What was the trial like?
So the trial was essentially that the body was discovered in, you know, the building in which, you know, it's undisputed that his family lived. And he had access to that basement, and that he had confessed to doing this. And oftentimes, because the crime was so gruesome, juries want to hold somebody responsible. And here they have, you know, words from Nevis Coleman's old mouth.
Well, what was his motive? Well, I wonder how they would say, why would he do it?
And that's the thing. You know, the confession is silent about the motive for this crime.
If I'm sitting in the jury pool, I have a luxury now that they didn't. And I'm sure those were good people who were trying to do just, but I think, why would a guy throw away his life and randomly rape and murder somebody? That just doesn't make sense.
What you're missing is that in the last 25 years, we have learned that false confessions do happen. That's something that in 1994, the jury pool didn't really know about.
How wonderful that they keep the DNA.
Yeah, well, in some cases, they don't. It really depends on how the evidence is stored and how robust the evidence sample is.
Still then, but tell me then what got the ball rolling again 2 decades later?
So Daryl Fulton wrote a letter to the state attorney's office.
Recently?
A
couple years ago?
Probably in about 2014, 2015. But with Kim Fox's election, she took a new look at this case. And I got involved because the DNA would be equally applicable to Nevis Coleman. And so the Exoneration Project agreed to represent Mr. Coleman pro bono because we looked at these facts. We said, there is no way that a guy who has no criminal history, his first crime is a first-degree murder and rape. That just doesn't happen. It doesn't make sense.
Well, you could have found otherwise. I mean, let's see what the DNA says.
Right.
But even the DNA isn't the judge and jury on this, right? I mean, maybe he was in the room and there was no DNA left on the victim. Maybe he was complicit somehow in the crime.
So you can say that, but we have to look at the evidence that we have. We can speculate all day what may have happened, but if the only evidence that was used to convict him was his confession, and the DNA excludes and exonerates every person mentioned in his confession, and it implicates a true perpetrator who has committed the same rape crimes to three other people, I mean, I don't have to work that hard to connect those dots.
Russell Ainsworth is in our studio. He's with the Exoneration Project and also with Lovey and Lovey Law. You're also a teacher at the University of Chicago's project. Is that right?
That's right. It's a law school clinic where we work with students to investigate crimes that where somebody's innocent.
So, you know, this story touched a lot of people, Russell, because it's just a shame, and it's another crime upon a crime that this man goes to jail for 23 years. And then you've got the White Sox connection, and that's, you know, and at first it kind of bugged me because that was this sort of nice feel-good story. And I'm like, no, wait a minute. This man will never be made whole, but he deserves a paycheck for, you know, what we did was we took, what was it, 23 years that he was in jail?
That's right.
We multiplied that by the median salary in Chicago over that period of time. We came up with about $1.4 million. Now, I need to pause. Come back and talk to me a little bit about should he expect any money, and if so, how does that go? We're talking about the story of Nevis Coleman, that now middle-aged man who 23 years ago was wrongly convicted of a rape and murder in Chicago. That's the guy that was the groundskeeper for the White Sox. So he's going to be there for the home opener, by the way. And you'll expect this story to pop up again. Evidence was kept, and the DNA now proves that he was not that woman's killer. And so he's free, thanks to the efforts from the Exoneration Project and people like Russell Ainsworth, who is in our studio. So what's next then? I mean, does this guy expect remuneration for the lost years?
So one thing that's remarkable about Nevis is that he doesn't, when he speaks about his experience, he's not angry because he understands that anger will only hurt himself. It will not bring anybody down. It will not fix the system. But he wants responsibility. He wants accountability. And so he's filed a federal lawsuit and he's seeking compensation for the 23 years he is deprived of his family. He had a 2-year-old daughter and a 3-month-old son when he went into prison. He spent over 2 decades, and this is something that many people don't necessarily think about because I think it's very uncomfortable. When you're innocent in prison, it turns your sense of justice upside down. The guilty man understands why he's there. He's being punished for a reason. He did something wrong, and you're being punished. For the innocent man, however, it blows your mind. You're there. You know you're not supposed to be there, but everyone tells you you're lying, and you are punished every single day for 23 years straight with no time machine coming back to say, don't worry, Nevis, you know, this is going to be a happy ending and you're going to get be with your family.
You have no hope. You're in there for life.
No. And when you're in there for life, you get sent to the worst of the worst places of the penitentiary system.
Where was he?
He was at Menard down in southern Illinois. It's rough. It is brutal. It's filled with people who have killed, who have raped, who've led very violent lives, and it's just a extraordinarily difficult place for a guy who had no criminal background to then be thrust into this world and have to survive for 23 years. And the fact that he comes out and, you know, he's working again. He worked throughout prison. That was his rock while he was in prison. He worked every day he could because that was some way to take his mind off of what was going on, and, you know, it made him feel better.
So put a number on it.
So juries in the, around the country value these cases at between $1 and $2 million per year.
That's per year?
Per year of incarceration. That's what we've seen from...
I'm not mad at that. I told you the math I did. I took what he would have earned if he had been an average Chicagoan for the time, and then I doubled it, and that got me to 3. But 23 times 1 is maybe 23. Do you seek an amount?
No, we don't. We leave it to whatever jury determines. And I'm telling you, this is what juries determine, what ordinary citizens seated in, you know, hear the evidence, hear from Nevis about what he had to endure. And they say, yes, $1 to $2 million per year.
So you are expecting that a jury, will it go to jury or will this settle? Can you just turn to the state or the city and say, what do we need? Maybe we don't have to go to trial on this, right?
So we only file cases if we think we can win at trial. And we expect this case will go to trial unless somebody tells me different.
I'm sorry, what will the charge be against whom? I mean, you're just seeking money here, right? It's a civil suit, right?
It's a civil suit, but
so
it's
can't you just settle that, or do you have to go to trial?
It could be settled. But
you're asking for a number that's larger, evidently, than they want to pay. So then we'll have a trial.
Exactly.
And what's that number?
So whatever, we don't put a number on it in the lawsuit.
You haven't done that already? You didn't seek to settle? You wanted to go to trial?
We filed because we thought that this is not only something for Nevis, but it's also something that the public deserves to hear about.
But is that a calculation you and Nevis have done? If you said, look, Nevis, they'll probably give you $23 million. I mean, that's just one. Usually these go for $2 million a year. But maybe they won't. Maybe they'll go $500,000 a year. And maybe you don't want to go through the whole rigmarole. So let's ask for $20 million. I mean, really, who among us can spend $20 million? I'm not saying it's about spending the money. It's about righting the wrong. But isn't $20 million as right as $40 million? You know what I mean? I mean, can you talk about this?
So in complex litigation like this, it's rare for a defendant to say, yes, you know, I'll agree to a number without conducting some discovery of their own. And the only way they can really get that discovery, and when I talk about discovery, I mean, you know, asking questions, sitting people down in depositions, and learning about the case, is by filing the lawsuit. And, you know, I welcome all scrutiny. You know, talk to Nevis as much as you want. Depose him. Ask him the questions, and he'll answer them for you.
What are you talking about? What kind of questions?
Questions about how he came to confess, about who he is, about whether he actually had any involvement in this crime.
Well, they're still all painting a very sympathetic picture of him because he's been exonerated, and it seemed like he led an exemplary life beforehand.
He was a literal altar boy. I mean, this guy, he's got a family.
He was an altar boy in the Catholic Church?
Yeah. He had Father Veneco, who came to testify on his behalf at sentencing. Father Veneco was there in the benches when he was freed. I mean, he's had the support of his church, his family. He has three siblings who were there all 23 years.
So when's the trial?
To be set.
And you expect he'll win?
I expect he'll win. But let's not forget that there are other victims in this case, because not only Nevis' family, but we also have the victim's family. The victim's family thought they had closure, and it was false. The wrong person was perpetrated.
I'm getting text messages about that. Here's a couple of examples. So the real perpetrator may be free today? How do we not know? This one says, who did the DNA come back to? And also, is that person implicated with Nevis in the crime? You said Nevis has not been implicated, but if they know it's somebody, you said we know who this person is, right? What's the name of the person?
They have not released the name to me.
They're looking for this person? I hope. I mean, presumably this person isn't already incarcerated somewhere, and he's on the loose. Is he in Chicago?
I do not know.
You're not being coy with me.
I'm not being coy with you. What I'm saying is that because the wrong person was forced to confess by these detectives, Detectives Boudreaux, Halloran, O'Brien, and others, the real perpetrator was left on the street to victimize three other women. After this crime, three other women.
What happens to the police officers then?
So they've all retired. They have their pensions. And part of our lawsuit is to hold them accountable, you know, by asking for an award of punitive damages against those detectives.
Oh, so you're not just suing the city, you're suing these individuals.
That's correct. We think that they should be responsible for what they've done.
Russell Ainsworth is a partner at Lovey and Lovey Law and a teacher with the University of Chicago Exoneration Project. I hope you join us again in the studio. Let's follow this story together. Will you be at the ballpark tomorrow with your client?
I'll be there Friday, actually.
Okay.
But thank you, and it's been a pleasure here.
John Russick's in our studio, and he is the Vice President for Interpretation and Education on Chicago at the Chicago History Museum. They have a gallery there this year, right now, the MLK Gallery, titled Remembering Dr. King, 1929 to 1968. And as much as we are all focusing on Martin Luther King, and we have staff, Domitipango is in Memphis today, Chicago certainly has plenty of intersections with Martin Luther King Jr. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Tell me a little bit about this. He lived in Chicago for less than a year?
Yeah.
When was that?
1966.
How old is he then?
So he's born in 29, so, you know,
yeah,
37.
Towards the end of his life, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things that I think most of us are sort of familiar with, the sort of broad outlines of King's life, born in the South, sort of has this moment of national attention that's paid to him when he's working on the bus boycott and those sorts of moments in Memphis and Birmingham and different marches, and then culminating with the speech in Washington. But there's less known about his life in between 63 and 68 by the general public, and a lot of that is spent here in Chicago.
Yeah. So what do you then show? What do we learn when we go to the museum here?
Well, when you're looking at the exhibit, what we thought would be really interesting is to really dive into that piece, you know, look at King's life. We map out the whole of his life. So if you come to the exhibition, you'll get a sense of where he started and where he ended. But you'll also see a lot of focus on these years between 63, let's say, and 68, and primarily 63 and 66.
So he was an activist here then, too. He was organizing rallies and marches and boycotts.
Yeah. I mean, King realizes as and sort of helps the nation realize that what had been perceived as a Southern problem, the issue of racism or inequality, racial inequality in America that had been really sort of defined as those old Confederate states were the problem. King comes to Chicago and sort of reveals not only to himself but to the rest of us that racism is everywhere. It's an American problem, and it's a bigger issue. It's going to be more complicated to resolve it if these progressive northern cities also are rife with violent racism.
Was he surprised to see how endemic it was here, too?
You know, he certainly acted as if he were taken by surprise by it. But I think at the same time, he understood that, you know, part of his philosophy was to, you know, bring things to other people's attention. He was confrontational, not in a nonviolent way. So he felt like you sort of needed to expose these issues before you could hope for any sort of change. You wouldn't get change just as a matter of course. You had to sort of provoke people to look at things differently.
You directed me to some what I saw online as rare video and audio of him in Chicago. I'm going to play a little bit of that here. Let me just play the first clip and then tell me a little bit more about what we just heard. This is Martin Luther King in Chicago talking about the importance of his movement based on what he saw here.
Let us go as we have gone over these last few days in the right spirit, with the same discipline and dignity, and above all, with the same determination and the same courage, for we have been called to an indescribably significant responsibility, and that is to save the soul of America. And it may well be that what is happening in Chicago today will determine the destiny of the United States of America.
So what did you hear there? What was that all about?
Well, I think one of the things that you learn when you look at Dr. King for any length of time is you discover what a knowledgeable person he was, how well he understood sort of the American promise, right? He really understood what all men are created equal needed to mean in order for it to be true in a democracy, how everybody had to be able to participate, everybody had to be free, everybody needed some certain qualities in their life in order to participate in that promise. And you can hear in that speech him talking about the soul of America. How are we going to redeem the country to realize the ideals that it set out at that point, you know, 150 years earlier than he's talking, right? You know, 200 years earlier than he's talking almost. He's describing something that every school kid is learning about, but actually we're not seeing how much we're denying it and maybe not living up to our own ideals.
He never fails to impress me with his vocabulary and his delivery. One of the great orators and voices. He was the whole package. And even then, as he's delivering the movement, that message, you kind of feel the anger, but you also hear him sort of counsel restraint at the same time. I mean, it's just magical the way he talks.
And, you know, when you listen to the men who surrounded him at the time, who talk about what it was like to be in his presence and to work with him over the years, they talk about anger welling up inside them and the challenges of managing that, and that he was at the soul of that. He was able to channel their anger back into nonviolent behavior over and over and over again. It was a miraculous
skill. They didn't break ranks very early. Do we have a lot of history of guys saying, hell with it, we're on our own? I mean, we know that some of Malcolm X had a different attitude about how to deal with this issue, but I don't. It sure did seem like he was able to get the cooperation he needed from his followers.
Absolutely, and I think one of the great real lessons from the exhibition for me was looking at these years 65, 66, 67. You're really seeing King pulled dramatically in multiple directions. Yeah. He's fighting the fight against this entrenched racism that is in America, sometimes not even recognized by the people he's up against.
Well, listen to this. I've got two cuts for you. This is him talking about a local boycott that he's trying to organize.
We are demanding a certain number of jobs from Pepsi-Cola. And until Pepsi-Cola is willing to give these jobs, we are boycotting. I think Jesse Jackson is here now. He was here, and he could give a better report on that. But a number of stores have already agreed to take PepsiCo.
Stores being asked or ordered not to buy PepsiCo.
Well, they are being asked in very nice, nonviolent terms not to buy PepsiCo. And if they keep them on their shelves, well, we just won't buy from that store. That's all.
What do you hear in that?
I hear a man who's got a national perspective. He understands the power of the purchasing power of the people he's representing.
Yeah, but what about that question? Are they being asked or ordered? What was that all about?
Dr. King knew he had a lot of influence, and he understood that his word meant something.
But does that presume that the reporters were questioning sort of the authenticity of the movement? That is, are people really doing this? I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into that. I thought that was kind of an odd question for them to ask. Are people doing it of their own volition? Is this really a grassroots movement? Or is this top-down, you guys telling the people what to do? I was hearing that.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. I don't think that you could say that Dr. King had any power over these people other than the power of persuasion. That's what he had. He was a charismatic man. I think people have talked about this many times over, about being in his presence being sort of one of those remarkable moments.
But they're also
lives.
Making him responsible then for whatever happens too.
Absolutely. Okay. And he was a master of the boycott by this time. You also have to understand that he's already had the bus boycott behind him, and he has a track record of success in this formula.
So here he is on a planned march, and I'm not sure exactly what the place is. We'll listen to it together. It sounds like South Deering.
Well, it's just another closed community and a glaring expression of the overall problem in Chicago. We've already tested in South Deering. We face the same thing there that we faced in other communities, and that is an absolute rejection of absolute rejections. So we felt that we needed to move on in this community. We've touched several, and we plan before the summer is over, if there is no resolution of the problem in terms of a settlement, to go into all of the closed communities, all of the communities that exclude Negroes. And it's just another one of those communities.
It's so interesting to me to hear him speak so casually about something that today we would find abhorrent, but communities that say, no, blacks cannot live here. It wasn't 1,000 years ago. This is the late 1960s. It's
right.
Amazing.
Well, and you think that the racially restrictive covenants that were written into most property contracts in Chicago were only struck down in 1948. So, the whole mechanism that was in place to keep blacks out of certain neighborhoods, and not just blacks. I mean, it was broader than that, but that was clearly part of their target, and that was still a practice even after the Supreme Court had weighed in that it was unconstitutional.
We're talking to John Russick. He's vice president over at the Chicago History Museum with the vice president for interpretation and education at the museum. And their gallery is Remembering Dr. King, 1929 to 1968. Have you seen this? I have another clip I want to play for you. at a rally and get your reaction to. And tell us more about the exhibit in a minute. The MLK Gallery they have is Remembering Dr. King, 1929 to 1968. News in 5 minutes. By the way, a body was found in the Lincoln Park Lagoon today. News about that right around the corner. You and I were talking off the air. And by the way, ChicagoHistory.org. ChicagoHistory.org is where you will find online the Chicago History Museum. It's at North and Clark, and it's open 7 days a week, late on Tuesdays, noon to 5 on Sundays, 9:30 to 4 most days. Take advantage of this resource. At the end of the day, Martin Luther King's connection to Chicago is what?
Well, it's really important, and I think part of the reason we did the exhibition is because it gets left out a little bit, I think, in the story of King's rise and his significance in American history. You know, it's not until he comes to Chicago that we really get to see this racism, that this American-style racism exposed for what it is. And this idea that that King provokes that to come out and show its ugliest form right here, throwing rocks and bottles at him, talking about white power and you know, just the evidence that is demonstrated for not just Chicago but for the rest of the nation that this problem isn't a simple Southern problem that can be dealt with a boycott or an election. It is virulent, it's substantive, and it's going to have to be rooted out if we're going to address it.
Well, I listened to his speech in Chicago, and the clips I don't have time to play, but it's the same sort of angry white mob saying, hey, all you N's, don't you try and take the power or the rights from us whites. I mean, it's just alarming what you hear. And I guess it's not shocking that it came from people in Chicago, but it did. I mean, it is every bit a Chicago problem then as it was a Memphis or Washington, D.C. or a southern city. It was the same rhetoric that was being hurled at him here in this city.
Right. And you know, at the end of the day, what the Chicago History Museum hopes to do is talk about Chicago, show why Chicago is a critical element in understanding our nation and our democracy. And certainly, Dr. King helped us see a piece of ourselves. It might not be pretty, but it definitely is a part of who we are. And we need to be able to look at these things square in the eye.
ChicagoHistory.org. John Russick, thanks for coming in. Let's have more conversations like this.
I'd love to.
How long does the MLK exhibit run?
It's up through the national holiday next January. So, you know, you can if you don't get to it this week when we're all talking about Dr. King again, any time over the summer and the fall, and of course next mid-January, we'll be there. So a great place to bring your kids.
To North and Clark. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis in the studio.
Hi, John.
Thank you, John.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up on the program, just in the first hour, we'll go down to Memphis for Domati Pongo, is with Ryan Burrow as we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Domati's in the Sun-Times today. Nice big story he wrote for them.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. You know, you meet these guys in our business and you go, we won't know him for very long.
Will he remember us in five years?
My guess is not. Mm-hmm. My guess is he will be.
Hey, Domati, it's Ro and Anna.
Yeah.
How are you?
Do you remember us?
Yeah.
No. Now, hello.
We're borrowing him. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So it's kind of where we are with Lester. You know, somehow, I don't know how we've gotten Lester back on the show. But
I am amazed at some of the guests you regularly have on your show, and he's one of them. I'm thinking, he's got stuff to do, Ro. He can't be chatting with you all the time.
I always get nervous when we talk to him because I feel like, gosh, he's got to get back to something.
Shouldn't
you know?
He be in makeup or typing? Or I don't know what anchors do, but it's crazy.
Well, there's a lot of prep.
So we, yes. Well, I have, I've known a lot of guys for a long time, and I got a lot of pictures.
So he's like, I'll call Ro, don't worry.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Yeah, you know how deep the doo-doo is Ro's got on somebody by how long they agree to come on with him.
That's why Brett Baer actually moved in with us for a month. Anyway, the point is this, that Domati is going to be with us. Also, we'll be checking in with Dr. J, John Najarian, of course. You hear him on many of the shows on this program, on this mm-hmm. station, and the Chinese tariffs. And then we will talk to an Illinois pig farmer.
I was hoping you would.
About their reaction to this.
Oh, the China thing.
Yes. Brian Duncan, Vice President of the Illinois Farm Bureau, is going to join us as well. And there is some concern. Now, in the meantime, the president has announced he's going to the border. It's always one thing or another. They're sending troops down the border. But I got to tell you something.
I may surprise you on this.
Hmm.
But
you're on board?
I am on the, as it was described by Secretary Nielsen of the Department of Homeland Security today, her explanation for what it is that they're doing, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it is actually very reasonable.
Well, I'd love to hear that, because what I heard was that the illegal border crossings coming this way are the lowest they've been in 30, 40 years.
She says it's not true. She says they're actually back to almost pre-Trump levels.
Okay, I'll get out of the way and listen. You guys have a really good show.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.